From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
More and more people are coming to the state of Illinois in search of abortion care in the 2 years since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision overturned the 50-year Roe v. Wade ruling. Planned Parenthood of Illinois says 25% of its patients are from out of state, compared to about 4% pre-Dobbs. While clinics say they were prepared for the influx, the future of all reproductive care is still under threat.
2 years have passed since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade. A lot has changed in the abortion landscape. Illinois has become a destination for those seeking the procedure. We'll talk about Illinois' role and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And our guest this week is Mawa Iqbal. She covers state government for WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio stations. Mawa, it's good to have you back with us once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So before we get into the other topics, I do want to mention some breaking news and let people know we are recording this show a little bit earlier than normal this week due to some scheduling issues. A Supreme Court decision has come down as we record this show. This is one that we've been following, even though this is a case out of Indiana. The court today overturning a bribery conviction for a former Indiana mayor. And Mawa, fill us in on this case and what it could mean here in Illinois.
Yeah, so basically, this Indiana mayor, they sided with James. The court sided with James Snyder, who was convicted of taking $13,000 from a trucking company after prosecutors said that he steered about $1 million worth of city contracts their way. So Snyder, of course, maintained his innocence and says the money was payment for consulting work. He's the mayor of the small Indiana city of Portage. And so some people say that, you know, as far as the Madigan trial, which is now set for October here in Chicago, this Supreme Court case could potentially impact that trial as well.
Yeah. And Charlie, you think it may have some impact on Madigan, may have impact on some other cases as well.
Yeah, and one of the early stories I read out of it, this was online, it mentioned that of the 23 counts Madigan faces, seven of them are tied to the law in question. And it's also involved in most of the counts in the separate case dealing with the so-called ComEd 4. And so there will be a lot of activity going forward, I suspect, in motions being filed, briefs being filed, as we look at these trials that are going to go forward. Madigan's trial is set for October, and sentencing hearings for the four ComEd folks are also on hold, and they were waiting for the results of this particular case. And the main question that the court had to consider was whether, in addition to bribery, the law that was at question in Snyder's case also criminalized something called a gratuity. And the prosecutors argued that the gratuity is a reward given corruptly, but without a quid pro quo, for an act that has already happened. But what the Supreme Court, the majority, the 6-3 majority ruled, is that gratuities don't count. There's got to be a actual quid pro quo. And it was interesting that the dissenters argued that the reading of the law that gratuities aren't covered, they said it was absurd and atextual. And they said the opinion was one only today's court could love.
Well, one of the other cases that's out there, of course, in fact, a sentencing just took place for the former Chicago alderman, Ed Burke. And there had been some push by Burke's attorneys to delay the sentencing until after this decision came down. Of course, that did not happen. So, Charlie, first, your thoughts on the sentence that Burke received, which was basically 2 years and some fines. He's 80 years old. Their prosecutors, I believe, had been looking for up to a decade in prison for him. So he got much less than what was originally thought. But I guess this decision could impact his case as well.
I'm not that familiar with the all the ins and outs of it, but I'm thinking what he was accused of doing and convicted of doing wasn't that somebody gave him rewards after the fact. It was he was out actively soliciting things ahead of time, business for his property tax law firm, in return for favorable actions that he would take. So I don't think there's going to be much, what would you say, much relief for former Alderman Burke in this. One of the things that is also interesting, people, the critics have said, boy, does he get off easy, because he was a crook. He should have gone for the full 10 years. But in his in his defense, and his defense argued that to sentence him to 10 years, it would be a death sentence for him, because he's very elderly. He's going to turn 81 in a couple months, I believe. He's had problems with cancer and other physical ailments. And so he's, it's in my mind, it's not really unreasonable that he doesn't get a full 10 years. And it was interesting because one of his former colleagues in the city council, former Alderman Dick Simpson, said that, and Simpson has become, he's now a professor emeritus at University of Illinois Chicago. He's become kind of a reformer. He always was kind of a reformer, but he commented that, and this is his quote, "You have to remember that Burke is now over 80 years old and not in the greatest of health. So this will be a trying experience for him and a warning to anybody else." And it struck me that what Simpson was also hinting at was that this kind of a conviction for someone like Ed Burke, who had a reputation of being a, what would you say, sort of a statesman and above it all, and quoted Cicero and stuff like that on the floor, it's a real comeback, or come down, pardon me, it's a real come down for him.
Well, let's, and of course there'll be legal maneuvering on these cases as we go forward, so we'll have to wait and see how things play out there. But let's go back to a case that was decided over a couple of years ago now, 2 years ago this week. It's known as the Dobbs decision, and this basically overturned Roe v. Wade and really set a chain reaction off among states of whether or not states were going to be, like Illinois, an abortion haven, as they like to call it, or maybe one where it's much more restricted or even completely illegal. And certainly Illinois, from day one, MAWA, Governor J.B. Pritzker and other abortion rights supporters in this state have been clear that Illinois is going to protect the right for a woman to choose. And certainly that's what's happened. You've been following the anniversary of this decision this week. So where does Illinois stand? For people that don't follow this as closely, where does the state stand when it comes to allowing abortion and other reproductive health care?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, what you mentioned earlier with a lot of abortion rights advocates calling Illinois a quote-unquote safe haven for abortion, it's really kind of true. I mean, like, ever since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade 2 years ago now, the state legislature has passed a number of protections and expansions of abortion care, gender-affirming care, and IVF access, in vitro fertilization access, just like the whole spectrum of reproductive care. In particular, what's been a focus for a lot of pro-abortion rights lawmakers here is passing what's known as shield laws. So for all these patients who are coming in from other states where abortion access may be rather limited, so like surrounding states like Missouri and Indiana, but even like states that are kind of far away, like Texas, you know, these shield laws are meant to protect these patients and providers who are coming to Illinois from facing persecution from their home states for coming to Illinois to seek this care. And so, when we, you know, in our talk show, we sat down with Jennifer Welch, who's the CEO of Planned Parenthood of Illinois, and Megan Hayefo, who runs a Chicago Abortion Fund. And they were basically talking about how, in these past 2 years, the number of patients that they've seen has just skyrocketed. And it's a lot of it, a lot of these patients come from all over the country. Like Welch was saying that, you know, as far as people coming from other states, she says that they have people coming from 41 different states for abortion care. But in addition to that, a lot of these people are in need of financial assistance. So stuff like, you know, help covering travel costs and hotel costs and appointment costs. And I believe the Chicago Abortion Fund said that they've raised $7 million for out-of-state patients needing help covering these costs since Roe fell. Same thing with Planned Parenthood. They said that, you know, on average, they would spend about $200 in patients' assistance, but now the average is $500. So they were saying that it kind of goes to show that, like, while Illinois, you know, like, definitely has become this quote unquote safe haven for abortion rights and abortion care, there's still a lot of financial barriers that remain, especially for people who are coming from places like Texas or even further than that to Illinois.
So, Mawa, what are they saying comes next here in the state of Illinois? There's been discussion about other legislation, other actions that the state might decide to take, especially with full Democratic control in the Illinois General Assembly and governor's office. What could possibly be coming down the road?
I mean, there's always the possibility that the legislature introduces a ballot initiative to codify abortion access into the state constitution. It's interesting, though, because that's something that Governor Pritzker campaigned on when he was running for re-election a couple of years ago. And actually, during his inauguration speech last January, so January of 2023, he did say, like, he made a whole point that, like, we must codify abortion access into Illinois because there are states all around us that are trying to do the opposite, that they're trying to strip this access away or limit it greatly. And so, you know, it's interesting because a couple months ago at an unrelated press conference, when Pritzker was asked about, you know, why haven't they done this? Like, why hasn't there been more of a push to get this abortion access codified? He kind of changed his tone a little and was like, well, it's not really that important for us to do it right now because, like, you know, we're not like Florida where, you know, abortion access and all kinds of other access to different healthcare is being stripped. You know, we're Illinois where we, you know, are working to protect abortions here. So we don't really need to codify it. But of course, you know, a lot of advocates, a lot of abortion providers, a lot of pro-abortion rights lawmakers, too, are still trying to hold out hope and still saying, like, no, we still need to codify abortion to the Constitution just to make sure that it's really solidified, right? Like, in case there's an administration change, you know, it's still there for people.
Yeah, Charlie, Illinois has always been a little bit more, I guess you would say, more progressive on this issue than some of the neighboring states. But it's not as though there haven't been laws in place here in the state of Illinois to restrict abortion, certainly after a certain number of weeks. Certain other ways that abortion was restricted in the state. So, you know, it's interesting to watch this shift that has come down. And I guess this is what happens when you leave it up to the states. You're going to have states go maybe pretty far in one direction and far in another direction. That's what's happened here, it appears.
Yeah, and it has. And I think it's interesting because we talked about the possibility of a constitutional amendment. The soonest that that could happen would be in 2026. And there was a comment from State Representative Kelly Cassidy, who's a Chicago Democrat, who's been in the forefront of passing pro-choice measures. And she was pointing out that the time and the energy and the funding that would be used to try and pass the constitutional amendment, and this was in this past spring session, could make a material difference in states without the safeguards that we have in Illinois. And here's her quote. We are sitting here on pretty good laws. We've got time. We could let other states have that runway. So I think that kind of makes sense. And thinking back on it, and again, this is ancient history now, but after Roe v. Wade came down, the pattern in the Illinois legislature was that the anti-abortion, the pro-life people, would be able to pass legislation restricting abortion and putting all kinds of limits on it. Governor Thompson would routinely veto those bills. The General Assembly would routinely override his vetoes. It'd be challenged in court, and the the laws would be deemed unconstitutional in the wake of Roe v. Wade. Now, that has changed, and instead of going through this kind of, what do you say, artificial dance, Illinois has stepped up, I think, to become, as you said earlier, Mava, one of the almost like an island in the Midwest for women who are seeking this procedure. And we, I don't know what other steps we can take. I mean, we've already limited the ability of law enforcement officials from some of the states that make abortion criminal. We won't share any information that we have from our license plate readers or from our law enforcement about who's coming here and why they're coming. We've done a lot to protect women's rights.
And I would never doubt that J.B. Pritzker feels very strongly about this issue. He's made this clear that he was supporting a woman's right to choose going way back into the 90s and 80s and such when he was first becoming more involved in politics. But now with this such a main issue on the national stage, he has certainly leaned into it even more, starting MAWA, his own campaign fund for it, that air fund that he has out there to support other abortion-friendly lawmakers and candidates around the country. So this is an issue where J.B. Pritzker has really made a stand on.
Totally, yeah. No, he has the whole Think Big America where he is, trying to really prop up abortion rights around states. And it's something that I think will definitely come up later, like as he decides to run again or if he runs for higher office. So who knows in a couple of years. So it'll definitely be interesting to see, how his attitude shifts on, abortion, which I don't think overall it will, but perhaps when it comes to codifying it into the Constitution, he might return to that. And as like a way to drive out voters to the polls. Well, we'll see.
And I expect we'll hear him at the Democratic National Convention later this summer. I expect he will raise this issue there, probably on a national stage at that point. Let's move on here just a little bit. We have another case that I did want to mention. We talked about this on the show a bit last week. This case involved domestic abusers and basically their right to have guns. And the Supreme Court weighing in saying they could have their guns taken away. This has some interest here in Illinois, even more so because there's some legislation that's pending. Mawa, where does that stand?
Yeah, so the legislation is called Karina's Bill, named after Karina Gonzalez, who is a woman in Chicago who was fatally shot and killed along with her 15-year-old daughter, allegedly by her then domestic partner. And so in that case, she had gotten a restraining order, so an order of protection against him, citing dangerous behavior and drug use. But the judge had not ordered the confiscation of his guns. There was a confiscation or an order to confiscate his firearm ID card, but not his actual firearms. And so, allegedly the man went and used his firearms and killed Karina and her daughter. And so basically this law this legislation, what it would do in Illinois, will kind of make sure that, in cases where a judge grants an order of protection to someone against someone who they suspect is an abuser, a domestic abuser, then in addition to that, they will also order the confiscation of their firearms. And so this is something that was introduced like not soon after Karina's and Daniela's death last spring. And it failed then. They tried reviving it the last fall veto session. It also failed then. And then they tried reviving it again this spring session, and it failed for a third time. And pretty much, the main holdup is, I think what we're hearing is from lawmakers and from different stakeholders is there's a lot of concern with police groups about how this law will actually be carried out. So a lot of police groups are worried that, if you're ordering police officers to go and confiscate these guns, right, like it's going to put them in a very dangerous situation potentially. And like the window to do that is not long enough, right? Like they're going to need more time. And especially if they're a smaller, more rural department, they're going to need more police officers to execute that search. And also, where would they store these confiscated guns? So there's still some pushback and some concerns that remain from law enforcement groups. And so one thing that the sponsor of the bill, Senate sponsor Selena Villanueva, who actually her district office was not too far from where Karina and Daniela lived, but she was saying, that they were going to watch and wait for this Supreme Court case to see like how that played out. And then, if it ruled the other way, where it is a violation of someone's Second Amendment right to confiscate their guns, then she said that they would have to change course. But now, of course, since the court ruled that it's in fact not a violation of a person's Second Amendment right to take away your guns during this order of protection window, then yeah, a lot of advocates seem pretty hopeful. They seem very confident that this should really get through like next fall veto session, which will be sometime in November. So they're really hoping, they're really trying to push as much as they can, trying to use this moment of the Supreme Court ruling to really kind of get some momentum going to garner more support and hopefully get this passed in the fall.
Okay. And let's save a couple of minutes here because I also want to mention the governor made a bill signing this week. And Charlie, this is something that the governor's been touting now for a while. He wanted a Department of Early Childhood Education. He signed the bill into law, and so that's going to happen. You've said in the past you thought this was a good decision.
So under the legislation that the governor signed the other day, his new agency will take over early childhood block grant programs from the State Board of Education, which funds a couple of programs called Preschool for All Prevention Initiative, the Child Care Assistance Program, the Home Visiting Program, and Early Intervention Services that are now in the Department of Human Services, and daycare licensing now in the Department of Children and Family Services. And the governor's point is that by consolidating these programs under one department, it would make it easier for new parents to access these services for their children. And his quote is, "It's hard enough juggling all the responsibilities that fall on the shoulders of parents. On top of that, they shouldn't have to navigate a complex bureaucracy to get the care that they and their children deserve." And it passed through the General Assembly basically with little opposition. There was no opposition in the Senate. The House approved the bill 93 to 18. And the new budget appropriates $14 million in the coming fiscal year for startup costs. And it's unclear how much might be needed in the future, but Prisker suggested it may not require any additional money other than the operation costs, because the programs that are being removed from the other three agencies then will be taken out of those agencies' budgets and put into the new agency's budget. He said there's real efficiency in taking programs that are spread out in different departments and bringing them all together under one roof, so to speak.
So, Mawa, you covered this as it made its way through the legislature. It seemed like most of what I was hearing was that cost concern because there weren't a whole lot of numbers thrown around.
Yeah, definitely. That was pretty much the biggest, I think concern what was just like how much would it cost? And right now the way that the law is written is that they would basically have this new agency running by July 1st, 2026. So it's not too long from now. It's really like two years from now.
So this is something that he pushed forward in his budget, of course, and I think he talked about it even before that, going back maybe, I don't know, a year or two ago. And he's got other programs that are out there. So not shocking, I guess, to see this happen, but this is something that's been on the table for a while.
Governor Pritzker has been very, very proactive in terms of providing opportunities for young children. Last year, he created a multi-year Smart Start initiative aimed at improving access to preschool, increasing funding for childcare providers, investing in early childhood facilities. And there's even $200 million in the budget that's going to take effect in a few days for childcare workforce compensation contracts. So that's intended to give childcare workers a raise, because one of the problems that the providers are having is finding personnel because of the low salaries.
I did want to mention again before time runs out on us, And this is from another one of the WBEZ Illinois Public Radio reporters, Alex Degman, that the House Speaker Chris Welch trying to get a lawsuit against him thrown out. Some of the Democratic House Speaker's employees back in May filed suit against him in Cook County. They claim he's denying them their constitutional right to collectively bargain. But Welch's lawyers say state law does not let individuals sue over perceived constitutional violations, and that Welch is immune from civil suits in almost all cases while acting in his legislative capacity. They want the lawsuit dismissed. We'll continue to follow that story as well. Let's go now to our notes from the field, and Mawa, we'll start with you.
Last week, President Joe Biden announced a plan. It was a pathway to citizenship plan for immigrants in the U.S. And basically, it's an executive order that would allow some non-citizen spouses of U.S. citizens to basically stay in the country while they apply for permanent residency. And so currently, many non-citizens would first have to leave the U.S. and just basically stay in their home country while they're waiting to be processed, which could take like years, right? So President Biden thought, let's just like have people stay together, like in the U.S. Because of course, like being apart in a different country for several years can take a toll on the relationship, on the family. And so, I talked to some lawmakers, some federal lawmakers from Illinois about like what this law could mean and how it could help people. And one Congresswoman, Delia Ramirez, who's from Chicago, she's a Democrat. She says she has kind of mixed emotions about it, that while this is a great thing for people who have lived in the U.S. for 10 years or longer and children of these spouses would be eligible, it's leaving a lot of other people out, particularly those who are seeking asylum. So she says that she would hope to see some more, pathway to citizenship policies being enacted, especially for people seeking asylum.
And Charlie.
Well, last Monday was the deadline for independent and third party candidates to file petitions with the State Board of Elections for the presidency to be on the November 5th general election ballot here in Illinois. And probably the most interesting filing was by Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s supporters. They filed approximately 60,000 petitions. He's the son, of course, of Robert F. Kennedy and a nephew of late President John F. Kennedy. But he's been at odds with people in his family for some time because of his controversial views on health-related issues. In any event, he filed, as did a Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, and as did the Constitution Party presidential candidate, Randall Terry of Tennessee, and placeholders for Libertarian candidate Chase Oliver. To be on the ballot, independent third-party candidates had to submit at least 25,000 valid registered voters, and their petitions will be checked and reviewed. Objections have to be filed by Monday, July 1st, so we will see.
That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Mawa Iqbal of WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. Don't forget to join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.